of each man at any given moment. They have the force of character to inspire exhausted rowers to dig deeper and try harder, even when all seems lost. They have an encyclopedic understanding of their opponents, how they like to race, when they are likely to start sprinting, when they like to lie in wait. Before a regatta, the cox receives a race plan from the coach, and he or she is responsible for carrying it out faithfully. But in a situation as fluid and dynamic as a crew race, circumstances often change abruptly, and race plans must be thrown overboard. The cox is the only person in the shell who is facing forward and can see how the field is shaping up throughout a race, and he or she must be prepared to react quickly to unforeseen developments. When a race plan is failing to yield results, it is up to the cox to come up with a new one, often in a split second, and to communicate it quickly and forcefully to the crew. Often this involves a lot of shouting and a lot of emotion. In Cal's Olympic gold medal race in Amsterdam in 1928, Don Blessing put on what the New York Times called one of the greatest performances of demoniacal howling ever heard on a terrestrial planet. But such language, and what a vocabulary. One closed one's eyes and waited for the crack of a final cruel whip across the backs of the galley slaves. In short, a good coxswain is a quarterback, a cheerleader, and a coach all in one. He or she is a deep thinker, canny like a fox, inspirational, and in many cases the toughest person in the boat. Little Bobby Mock was all of that and more. He had grown up in Montesano, a foggy little logging town on the Chehalis River in southwestern Washington. It was a wet, dusky world, a world dominated by big trees, big trucks, and big men. Massive Douglas firs and cedars grew in the misty hills outside town. Ponderous logging trucks rumbled through town on Highway 41, night and day on their way to the mills in Aberdeen. Beefy lumberjacks in thick flannel shirts and hobnailed boots strutted up and down Main Street, shot pool at the Star Pool Hall on Saturday nights, and sat in the Montesano Cafe drinking coffee by the gallon on Sunday mornings. Bobby's father, Gaston, a Swiss watchmaker and jeweler, was not a large man, but he was a prominent member of the citizenry, a proud member of the all-volunteer fire department, and was celebrated for having driven the first automobile 12 miles from Aberdeen to Montesano, a journey that he had accomplished in a jaw-dropping hour and a half. When Bobby was 5, a botched operation on his appendix nearly killed him. The recovery left him short, skinny, and sickly, afflicted with severe asthma throughout his grade school years and beyond. Determined not to let his frailty and his stature stand in his way, in high school he went out for every sport he could think of, mastering none but playing all of them tenaciously. When he couldn't make it onto the school football team, he and other boys who weren't large enough to make the cut gathered on a vacant lot just down Broad Street from his home, playing rough-and-tumble scrub football without benefit of helmets or pads. The smallest of the small boys on the lot, Bobby was always chosen last, and though he spent much of each game with his face planted in the dirt, he later credited the experience for much of his subsequent success in life. "It doesn't matter how many times you get knocked down," he told his daughter, Mary Lynn. "What matters is how many times you get up." In his senior year in high school, by sheer force of will, he lettered in, of all things, basketball. And the 3 pounds of gray matter he carried around in his skull served him well in the classroom. He wound up at the top of his class, honored as Montesano High's class valedictorian in 1932. When he enrolled at the University of Washington, he set his sights on coxing. As with everything else he attempted, he had to fight tooth and nail to win a seat in the stern of one of Al Ulbrichtson's boats. But once he was in that seat, his tenacity quickly made a believer out of Al Ulbrichtson. Like everyone else in the shell house, Ulbrichtson soon discovered that the only time Mock didn't seem entirely happy and comfortable in the coxswain's seat was when he was in the lead. As long as he could see another boat out ahead of him, as long as he had something to overcome, someone to beat, the boy was on fire. By 1935, Mock wielded the megaphone in the JV boat that contended with Joe and the other sophomores for varsity status that season. He wasn't a popular choice. He had displaced a well-regarded boy his new crewmates had been rowing with for 2 years, and they initially refused to give Mock the respect a coxswain absolutely depends on. That just made Mock push them harder. "That was a tough year. I wasn't liked at all," he later said. "I demanded they do better, so I made a lot of enemies." Mock drove these boys like Simon Legree with a whip. He had a deep baritone voice that was surprising in a man so small, and he used it to good effect, bellowing out commands with absolute authority. But he was also canny enough to know when to let up on the crew, when to flatter them, when to implore them, when to joke around with them. Slowly, he won his new crewmates over. The bottom line was that Bobby Mock was smart, and he knew how to use his smarts. In fact, by the end of the 1936 season, he'd have a Phi Beta Kappa key of his own to twirl on his finger, just like Al Ulbrichtsen. In late February, as he sorted through the boys, Ulbrichtsen began attaching more significance to which boats he labeled number one, number two, and number three. Joe had dropped from the number one to the number two boat. On February 20th, rowing hard in a heavy snow and a steady east wind, number two and number one came in about even. Joe's hopes rose. But a week later, Ulbrichtsen moved him down to the number three boat. The weather continued to be atrocious. Mostly the boys rowed anyway. Cold, rain, sleet, hail, and snow they simply ignored. But there were days when the wind whipped up the surface of Lake Washington so badly that nobody could row on it without being swamped. Despite the weather, the time trials turned in by the top boats were still good, but they weren't improving as rapidly as Ulbrichtsen had been hoping for at this point. He hadn't yet found a boat that would walk away from the others. And with all the cold weather rowing interspersed with days when they couldn't row at all, the boys' morale began to erode. "Too many gripers," Ulbrichtsen scrawled in the logbook on February 29th. One exceptionally stormy afternoon in early March, when the boys were lounging morosely about the shell house, George Pocock tapped Joe on the shoulder and asked him to come up into the loft. He had a few thoughts he wanted to share with him. In the shop, Pocock leaned over one side of a new shell and began to apply varnish to its upturned hull. Joe pulled a sawhorse to the other side of the shell and sat down on it, facing the older man. Pocock began by saying he'd been watching Joe row for a while now, that he was a fine oarsman. He noted a few technical faults, that Joe was breaking his arms at the elbow a little too early in the stroke and not catching the water as cleanly as he would if he kept his hands moving at the same speed that the water was moving under the boat. But that wasn't what he wanted to talk about. He told Joe that there were times when he seemed to think he was the only fellow in the boat, as if it was up to him to row the boat across the finish line all by himself. When a man rowed like that, he said, he was bound to attack the water rather than to work with it, and worse, he was bound not to let his crew help him row. He suggested that Joe think of a well-rowed race as a symphony, and himself as just one player in the orchestra. If one fellow in an orchestra was playing out of tune or playing at a different tempo, the whole piece would naturally be ruined. That's the way it was with rowing. What mattered more than how hard a man rowed was how well everything he did in the boat harmonized with what the other fellows were doing. And a man couldn't harmonize with his crewmates unless he opened his heart to them. He had to care about his crew. It wasn't just the rowing, but his crewmates that he had to give himself up to, even if it meant getting his feelings hurt. Pocock paused and looked up at Joe. "If you don't like some fellow in the boat, Joe, you have to learn to like him. It has to matter to you whether he wins the race, not just whether you do." He told Joe to be careful not to miss his chance. He reminded him that he'd already learned to row past pain, past exhaustion, past the voice that told him it couldn't be done. That meant he had an opportunity to do things most men would never have a chance to do. And he concluded with a remark that Joe would never forget. "Joe, when you really start trusting those other boys, you will feel a power at work within you that is far beyond anything you've ever imagined. Sometimes you will feel as if you have rowed right off the planet and are rowing among the stars." The next day was a Sunday, and as he had every weekend for weeks, Joe took Joyce and drove over to the lot on Lake Washington where his father was building his new house. The basement portion was nearly complete, and with the upstairs portion underway, Harry had moved into the basement with his children. It was more like a cave than a house, with one large garage-style door for an entrance and only one small window facing the lake. But Harry had lugged in a wood stove, and it was at least warm and dry inside. Joe and his father spent the morning hauling lumber from the road down to the construction site in a driving rain, then hoisting it up to the level of what would become the main floor of the house. Joyce entertained the kids inside, playing card games and making fudge and cocoa on the wood stove. She and Joe were worried about all four of them. They were still having a hard time adjusting to the loss of their mother. With Harry working on the house full-time, they weren't receiving much in the way of attention. They were frequently assaulted by terrifying dreams. Rose and Polly often cried when left alone, and although they had all remained in school, their grades were suffering. Joe had promised each of them a dime for every A they brought home. Now, Joyce was trying to think of motherly things she could do with them. Playing mother to Tula's children was easy and natural to Joyce in almost all regards. She saw grief-stricken children in desperate need, and every instinct within her impelled her to sweep them into her arms and nurture them. That's what she had done from the first time she had seen them after Tula's death. The resentment and anger she still felt toward Tula she kept locked away deep down inside, safely out of view of the children. What was harder for Joyce, though, was to know what to do and what to feel about Joe's father. They got along well enough on the surface. Harry treated her pleasantly, even warmly, and she tried to reciprocate. But inside, Joyce still seethed. She could not forget or forgive Harry for his failure to stand behind Joe for all those years, for his weakness, for letting Tula cast Joe aside as if he were nothing more than a stray dog. And the more she brooded on it, the more it made her angry. By late that afternoon, Joe and his father had moved all the lumber into position, and with the rain falling harder than ever, Harry started to retreat into the house. Joe shouted after him, "I'll be inside soon, Pop," and walked out onto the dock at Fred's house next door, looking out over the heaving gray and white folds of the lake, pondering the near future. The finish line for the Pacific Coast Regatta in April was a little less than a mile up the lake from there. Would he be in the varsity boat when it passed this dock? He figured he probably wouldn't. Gusts of wind buffeted him. Rainwater poured down his face. He didn't care. He stared at the water, pondering what Pocock had imparted the day before, running the boatbuilder's words over in his mind. For Joe, who had spent the last 6 years doggedly making his own way in the world, who had forged his identity on stoic self-reliance, nothing was more frightening than allowing himself to depend on others. People let you down. People leave you behind. Depending on people, trusting them, it's what gets you hurt. But trust seemed to be at the heart of what Pocock was asking. Harmonize with the other fellows, Pocock said. There was a kind of absolute truth in that, something he needed to come to terms with. He stood on the dock for a long time, gazing at the lake, oblivious to the rain, thoughts assembling themselves, connecting with other thoughts, and drawing together in new ways. Harmony was something he understood as a musician. He and Harry Secor had worked together to stalk the giant Chinook salmon of the Dungeness River. He had watched and marveled at Charlie MacDonald's horses, Fritz and Dick, squatting and pulling together, moving enormous cottonwood trees as if they were matchsticks, the animals heaving and pulling in unison like one creature. Charlie had told him that they would pull until their harnesses broke or their hearts burst. On the cliff face of the Grand Coulee, he and the men he had worked with looked out for each other as they dodged rocks falling from above. In the evenings and on weekends, he and Johnny White and Chuck Day prowled B Street together, seeking adventure instead of advantage over one another. Joe turned and peered through a curtain of rain at the house his father was building. Just behind the house, a freight train lumbered past on the railroad tracks that the observation train would follow during the California race. Inside, the kids and Joyce and his father were all under one roof, sitting in front of the fire right now, waiting for him to come in out of the rain. And as he stood in the rain, Joe's feelings began to shift, moving around like notes on a musical staff, bits and pieces of new themes starting to fall into place. When he returned to the warm cave his father had constructed, Joe toweled his hair dry, unpacked his banjo, and pulled a chair up in front of the wood stove. He gathered the kids around him. He tuned the banjo carefully, fiddling with knobs and plucking at steel strings. Then he cleared his throat, cracked open a big white smile, and began to sing. One by one, the kids and Joyce and Harry all joined in. By March 19th, Al Ulbrichsen figured he had found his best bet for the Olympic boat. He still had it pegged as the second boat on his chalkboard, but the boys in it were beginning to edge the first boat consistently, and Ulbrichsen was quietly putting his final selections into this boat. At bow, he had Roger Morris, At number two, Chuck Day. At number three was one of Tom Bowles' freshmen from the previous year, Gordy Adam, the dairy farm kid from up on the Nooksack River near the Canadian border. Gordy had attended a two-room country schoolhouse, then Mount Baker High in the small town of Deming. Then he'd spent five brutal months fishing for salmon on the Bering Sea up in Alaska to put together enough money to start at the university. He was a quiet young man, so quiet that in the previous year's race against California, he'd rode the whole 2 miles with his thumb cut to the bone and never mentioned it to anyone. In honor of that, Royal Brougham had begun to refer to him now as Gordy Courage Adam. At number four, Ulbrichsen had lithe, good-looking Johnny White. Big, rangy Stubb McMillan was at number five. Shorty Hunt was at number six. At number seven was another of Tom Bowles' former freshmen, Merton Hatch. At the stroke position was a fourth member of last year's freshman crew, poker-faced Don Hume. It was an unusual move to put a 19-year-old sophomore at the critical stroke position, but Hume had proven so sensational as a freshman that many were already saying he might turn out to be Washington's best stroke since Ulbrichsen himself had rowed at that position, maybe even better. He hailed from Anacortes, then a gritty lumber and fish canning port 50 miles north of Seattle. In high school, he'd been the consummate all-around athlete, a star in football, basketball, and track, and an honor student. He was also an accomplished pianist, a devotee of Fats Waller, and capable of pulling off anything from swing tunes to Mendelssohn. When he sat down at a piano, he always drew a crowd. After the crash, his father lost his job at a pulp mill and moved to Olympia in search of work. Don stayed behind in Anacortes, lodging with family, friends, and eventually finding work in a lumber mill. Walking the cobbled beach on the channel between Anacortes and Guemes Island one day, he came across an abandoned and dilapidated 13-foot clinker-built rowboat. He refurbished it, took it down to the water, and discovered that he loved rowing. Loved it, in fact, more than anything he had ever done. For a year following his graduation from high school, he rowed obsessively, up and down the channel on foggy days, and on long voyages out among the San Juan Islands on sunny days. When the job at the lumber mill gave out and he decided to join his parents in Olympia, he rowed all the way there, a 6-day voyage that covered nearly 100 miles of water. That fall, he moved to Seattle, registered as a geology major at the university, and then made a beeline for the Shell House, where Tom Bowles and Al Ulbrichsen quickly discovered that they had an extraordinary athlete on their hands. Hume pulled as smooth as silk, and with the precise mechanical regularity of a metronome. He seemed to have an innate, deep-seated sense of rhythm. But more than that, his mastery of his oar, his steady reliability, and his rock-solid sureness were so apparent that every other boy in the boat could sense them immediately, and thus easily fall into sync with Hume, regardless of water conditions or the state of a race. He was key. In the stern of Ulbrichsen's star boat, wearing the megaphone, was, inevitably, Bobby Mock. Joe was in the third boat, and it looked as if he'd be staying there. So far, he hadn't even made the presumed JV boat, and so it looked as if he would not be rowing in the Cal race or beyond. But then, on March 21st, he walked into the Shell House and found his name on the chalkboard, sitting at seat number 7 in boat number 2, the boat everyone was talking about as the best bet for the varsity slot. He couldn't believe it. He didn't know if Pocock had talked to Ulbrichsen, or if Merton Hatch had simply messed up in some spectacular way, or if Ulbrichsen simply needed someone else at number 7 for the day. Whatever the reason, this was his chance. Joe knew what he had to do, and he found doing it surprisingly easy. From the moment he stepped into the Shell that afternoon, he felt at home. He liked these boys. He didn't know Gordy Adam and Don Hume well, but both made a point of welcoming him aboard. His oldest, most reliable Shell House friend, Roger Morris, sitting up front in the bow, gave him a wave and shouted the length of the boat, "Hey, Joe, I see you finally found the right boat." His buddies from Grand Coulee, Chuck Day and Johnny White, were sitting up near the front, too. As he strapped his shoes to the footboard and began to lace his feet into the shoes, Stubb McMillan, his face alight, said, "Okay, this boat is going to fly now, boys." Shorty Hunt slapped him on the back and whispered, "Got your back, Joe." Joe rowed that day as he had never been able to row before. as Pocock had told him to row, giving himself up to the crew's effort entirely, rowing as if he were an extension of the man in front of him, the man behind him, following Hume's stroke flawlessly, transmitting it back to Shorty behind him in one continuous flow of muscle and wood. It felt to Joe like a transformation, as if some kind of magic had come over him. The nearest thing to it he could remember was the night as a freshman, when he had found himself out on Lake Union with the lights of Seattle twinkling on the water and the breaths of his crewmates synchronized with his in white plumes in the dark, cold air. Now, as he climbed out of the boat in the twilight, he realized that the transformation wasn't so much that he was trying to do what Pocock had said, as that this was a bunch of boys with whom he could do it. He just trusted them. In the end, it was that simple. Ulbrichsen wrote in the logbook, "Changed Rance and Hatch, and it helped a lot." That turned out to be an understatement of considerable magnitude. It was the last change Ulbrichsen had to make. Over the next few days, the boat began to fly, just as Stubb McMillan had said it would. On March 22nd, it led all the other boats from start to finish. On March 23rd, it won by an astonishing 7 lengths in one race, and a commanding 3 or 4 in a second. On the morning of March 27th, in a heavy late spring snowstorm, it came in 3 lengths ahead. That afternoon, rowing a 2,000-meter sprint, Don Hume took the stroke up to a punishing 40. The boys fell in behind him flawlessly, and the boat flashed across the finish line well ahead of the others again. On March 28th, with light snow still falling, Ulbrichsen officially elevated the boat to varsity status. He wouldn't announce it to the press for a few more days, but the man had made the decision of his career. This was the crew with which he would attempt to go to the Berlin Olympics. That afternoon, George Pocock personally christened the new shell in which the boys would row in the trials. As Joe and his crewmates held the shell aloft, Pocock poured a jar full of mysterious fluid over its bow and pronounced, "I christened this boat Husky Clipper. May it have success in all the waters it speeds over, especially in Berlin." As the boys began to carry the boat down the ramp to the water, some of them crinkled their noses, trying to make out the odd scent of the fluid on the bow. Pocock chuckled. "Sauerkraut juice, to get it used to Germany," he grinned. On April 4th, Ulbrichsen held one final 3-mile time trial before officially announcing the boatings for the Pacific Coast Regatta. 2 miles into the trial, Bobby Mock kicked the beat up to 32 and settled in there. The 3-mile course record was then 16 minutes 33.4 seconds, set by the Washington varsity that Joe had watched from the ferry in 1934. Now, Joe and his crewmates came in at 16 minutes 20 seconds, and they did it sitting upright at the end of the race, breathing easy, feeling good. Every time they climbed into the Husky Clipper together, they just seemed to get better. There was a straightforward reason for what was happening. The boys in the Clipper had been winnowed down by punishing competition, and in the winnowing, a kind of common character had issued forth. They were all skilled, they were all tough, they were all fiercely determined, but they were also all good-hearted. Every one of them had come from humble origins, or been humbled by the ravages of the hard times in which they had grown up. Each in his own way, they had all learned that nothing could be taken for granted in life, that for all their strength and good looks and youth, forces were at work in the world that were greater than they. The challenges they had faced together had taught them humility, the need to subsume their individual egos for the sake of the boat as a whole. And humility was the common gateway through which they were able now to come together and begin to do what they had not been able to do before. But before the Olympic trials at Princeton, Al Ulbrichsen faced another daunting series of challenges. First, the Pacific Coast Regatta with California on Lake Washington. Win all 3 races there, and, Ulbrichsen figured, he might just convince the people of Seattle to again finance sending all 3 to Poughkeepsie for the national championships in June. Then, win or lose in Poughkeepsie, he would take the varsity to Princeton in July. Prevail there, and it would mean a trip to Berlin, another qualifying race or two, and finally the gold medal race against the best crews in the world. It was a tall order. But every time Al Ulbrichsen watched his new varsity crew take to the water, his confidence that he could pull it off grew. In Berkeley, Kai Ebright was, if anything, probably even more confident than Al Ulbrichtsen, both about the upcoming regatta in Seattle and about his Olympic prospects. He had almost certainly read about the 16-minute, 20-second, 3-mile time trial Ulbrichtsen's varsity had turned in, but the news couldn't have fazed him. His boys had already turned in a stunning 3-mile time of 15 minutes, 34 seconds on the estuary. The Shell had been running with the tide, but still, the difference was nearly a minute. On April 8th, he ran another time trial in Slackwater. His varsity came in at 16 minutes, 15 seconds, still 5 seconds better than Ulbrichtsen's crew. Guarding against complacency, Ebright allowed himself, when his crew reached the dock, only a gruff, "You look good out there for a change." The fact of the matter, though, was that Ebright had every reason to feel good about how things were shaping up for 1936, and he hadn't seen anything coming out of Seattle that would change his mind. He wasn't taking any chances, though. In fact, he was throwing everything he had into starting the Olympic year off right by beating Washington in Seattle. He'd begun the season by writing the names of each of his oarsmen on scraps of paper and throwing them into a hat. The Poughkeepsie champions ride along with all the other sophomore, junior, and senior contenders. Then he'd pulled names out one at a time to determine his initial votings. The point was that none of his boys could rely on past performance to gain a seat in the varsity boat. Each of them would have to earn it all over again. Things had shaped up nicely since then. The endless California sun had allowed him to work his boys at his own pace, culminating in a series of 3-mile pulls on the estuary that had left them well-conditioned and in top form. When he tried them at the shorter distance, they'd done just as well. Given that, and his shellacking of Washington in both Poughkeepsie and Long Beach the previous summer, he figured he was well-positioned to take the longer races at Washington and Poughkeepsie, and then move on to dominate the shorter races at the Olympic Trials and Berlin. In the last few weeks, he'd reinstated a tradition he'd employed before big races since his 1932 Olympic triumph, the varsity training table. Any boy who had worked his way into the top two varsity boats was entitled to sit down with his crewmates for a free dinner at Stevens Union on the Berkeley campus. Given the hard times, it gave his boys a powerful incentive to make it into one of those top boats. It also gave Ebright the ability to control the nutritional value of what his boys were tucking into. The training table fare was hearty, rich in protein and calcium in particular. Most nights, that meant a large, juicy steak and as much milk as a boy could drink. There was no budget for a training table in Seattle, but Al Ulbrichtsen was just as concerned as Ebright that his boys be well-nourished going into racing season. Ulbrichtsen's prescription was considerably less enjoyable than a steak. Every afternoon, the Washington boys were compelled to choke down first a glass of chalky-tasting pink calcium solution, then a glass of Knox sparkling gelatin. The gelatin sometimes proved tricky, depending on how and when it had been mixed. A fellow had to get it down his gullet quickly before it began to solidify, or he would gag on it. Later that year, after reading an article about Ulbrichtsen's nutritional regimen and contemplating his boy's success, a horse trainer named Tom Smith would go in search of hay with a high calcium content for a racehorse named Seabiscuit. Kai Ebright and his boys arrived in Seattle late on the afternoon of Tuesday, April 14th, and checked into the Edmund Meaney Hotel. Earlier in the day, Ulbrichtsen had sent his boys out in water so rough that they had not rowed in its like since the day in 1932 when Cal had defeated Washington by 18 lengths, and Washington had barely made it across the finish line before sinking. But when the Cal boys showed up at the Montlake Cut on Wednesday morning, the sun was out in full force, and the water was glass smooth. As they carried their shells down the ramp to the water, the national champion California boys were an intimidating sight. Seattle reporters marveled at how sun-bronzed they looked when seen side by side with the pallid boys from Washington. And if any of the riders assembled on the ramp that day harbored any doubt that Kai Ebright was taking the Washington threat seriously, those doubts were put to rest directly. Ebright himself promptly strapped on a megaphone, climbed into the coxswain's seat of his varsity boat, the California Clipper, and began barking commands as he took the boat out for an 8-mile pull far down Lake Washington, well out of sight of the Washington coaching staff. For the next 2 days, neither Ulbrichtsen or Ebright staged time trials, or if they did, they kept the results to themselves. Both coaches continued to issue the customary gloomy assessments of their boys' chances. Ebright yawned that his varsity was nothing to write home about, A good, average outfit, he called them. Ulbrichsen summoned up a deeper level of despair, calling the Bears the clear favorites before lamenting, "We have been handicapped this year by inclement weather." Then he flat-out lied. The boys are not exceptional. Saturday, April 18th, was a lovely day on which to watch a crew race, a hard day on which to row one. The skies were flawlessly blue. Temperatures promised to climb into the low 70s by race time. By mid-morning, a steady flow of warm air from the south had ruffled the blue surface of Lake Washington. With weather like this, the regatta promised to draw throngs of people to the beaches at the north end of the lake. Joe had come up with a scheme for profiting from the arrival of these throngs in his father's new neighborhood. He and Harry had bought 100 pounds of unshelled peanuts in 2 burlap sacks. The night before, Joyce, Harry, Rose, Mike, Polly, and Harry Jr. had stayed up late, transferring the peanuts to paper sacks, planning to sell them to the race fans. Now they had hundreds of sacks ready to go, and as soon as people began to show up in the early afternoon, Joyce and the kids fanned out along the beaches, hawking peanuts for 10 cents a sack. As in 1934, at 1 p.m., a ferry, this year the MV Chippewa, departed the University of Washington's oceanographic dock with a full load of students and the school's marching band. The Chippewa was elegantly appointed for a ferryboat. Many of her passengers, in fact, said that boarding her felt like boarding a North Atlantic liner, with Philippine mahogany paneling throughout the main cabin, a men's smoking room, a ladies' lounge, a full-service galley, red leather padded seats, and a glassed-in observation room up front. She was often chartered for special moonlight cruises, during which an elaborate loudspeaker system piped live music from the observation room throughout the ship. The Washington Marching Band now took up a position in the observation room, switched on the microphones, and began to play dance music. As they had 2 years before, young men in slacks and shirt sleeves and young women in flouncy summer dresses danced out of the cabin and onto the decks. As the Chippewa headed north up the lake toward the finish line at Sheridan Beach, a Navy cruiser and nearly 400 other vessels flying purple and gold pennants joined her. By now, the wind out of the south had stiffened considerably. Black smoke and white steam pouring from the larger vessel's stacks streamed briskly northward, and white caps began to dance at the north end of the lake, where the wind was piling the water up against the shore. At 2:15 p.m., an observation train left University Station and made its way to 125th Street for the start of the 2-mile freshman race. By now, the largest crowd ever to witness a crew race in the Northwest had assembled along the racecourse. Tom Bowles followed his freshman crew out to the starting line in his launch. Once again, he believed he had an outstanding bunch in his shell, but as is always the case for freshman coaches, he had no reliable way to assess his boys' true capabilities until he saw them racing against a major rival. They did not disappoint. When the freshman race went off promptly at 3 o'clock p.m., it looked as if it would be a close race. Cal leapt out into the lead, but the conditions made for tough rowing. Waves were quartering across the race course now, constantly threatening to throw the boats off keel. It was treacherously easy to catch nothing but air between waves or to dig too deeply into a wave and catch a crab. At the quarter-mile mark, the number 7 man in the Cal boat did just that, and all 4 oars on the starboard side came almost to a halt while they reset. When they got going again, the number 3 man caught another crab. In the meantime, Washington had quickly grabbed a substantial lead and then settled down to build on it. When they crossed the finish line 4.5 lengths ahead, their official time was recorded as 10 minutes 11.2 seconds. That would have eclipsed the 11 minute 24.8 second course record set by Joe and his freshman teammates in 1934 by well more than a minute. 4 other unofficial timekeepers reported a more reasonable time of 10 minutes 42 seconds, and the figure was revised. But it was still a new course record by a wide margin, and Tom Bowles remained undefeated on Lake Washington. Before the day was out, the East Coast schools, particularly Harvard, would take note of that. Bowles' days at Washington were numbered. The JV race began at 3:45 p.m., and for all intents and purposes, it was over 100 yards down the line. 4 of the boys in the Washington boat were veterans of Joe's all-sophomore crew of the year before, Bud Schacht, George Lund, Delos Schock, and Chuck Hartman. These were boys who knew how to row in rough water, and how to win. They took the lead easily at the start, widened it at each quarter-mile buoy, and crossed the line almost six lengths ahead of California. Their time, 16 minutes 14.2 seconds, beat the record set by Cal by almost a full minute. On the dock at Fred Rance's house, Harry and his kids and Joyce sat eating peanuts and tossing the shells into the lake. The sales that morning had been disappointing. They were going to be eating peanuts for a long while. Harry peered down the lake toward Sand Point with a pair of binoculars. The Philco radio in the house, a luxury he had bought secondhand for the occasion, was turned all the way up so they would be able to hear the NBC broadcast of the varsity race on KOMO when it began. Joyce dangled her legs over the edge of the dock. At the north end of the lake, a silver airplane circled the area of the finish line. She peered down into the water, past the floating peanut shells. She felt unsettled. Early that morning, she had cut Joe's hair as he sat perched on a chair in his little room at the YMCA, a towel fastened around his neck with a clothespin. It was a ritual Joyce performed once a month, and she always looked forward to it. It offered her a chance to be close to Joe, to chat with him privately, away from the eyes and ears of others, and it always seemed to please Joe, to relax him. That morning, though, as she worked methodically, combing his blonde hair up, measuring it carefully by eye, using the comb as a cutting guide, and snipping the hair as just the right length to create the crew cut he favored, Joe had been fidgety in the chair. Finally, she asked him what was wrong. He'd hesitated, struggling for words, but as she remembered it later, the gist of it was that there was something about this race, this boat, that was different. He couldn't really explain it. He just knew he didn't want to let this bunch of boys down. At 4:15 p.m., as the two varsity boats paddled out to the starting line, the NBC Red Network went on the air with coast-to-coast pre-race coverage. The tailwind had stiffened further, slicing up the length of the lake now, piling more rough water into heaps of whitecaps at the north end. So far, all four boats on the course that day had come in well ahead of the previous course records, even the losing boats. The long, upright bodies of the oarsmen were catching the wind, acting essentially as sails, hurrying the shells down the course. It was clear now that, absent an unforeseen disaster, somebody was about to set a new varsity record as well. At the start line, the Husky Clipper bobbed in the swells. Roger Morris and Gordy Adam up front struggled to keep the bow of the boat pointed due north under the relentless push of the quartering waves. Bobby Mock raised his hand to indicate his crew was ready to row. Over in the Cal boat, coxswain Tommy Maxwell did the same. In the coaching launches, idling in the water behind the shells, Al Ulbrichtsen and Kai Ebright were decidedly nervous. The fact was that neither of them knew quite what they were facing in the other boat. Both coaches had excellent crews and knew it. Neither was quite sure about the other man's crew. The boys in the California boat weighed a total of 1,557 pounds. The boys in the Washington boat weighed 1,561 pounds, just 4 pounds heavier. Both boats had savvy coxswains and powerful, experienced oarsmen. Both boats were state-of-the-art shells, Pocock's latest and greatest, sleek splinters of cedar, the Husky Clipper and the California Clipper. Both boats were 62 feet long and within a pound or two weighed the same. Both featured sleek cedar skins, 5/32 of an inch thick. Both had elegant yellow cedar washboards, ash frames, Sitka spruce gunnels, fore and aft decking made of silk impregnated with varnish. Most important, both featured Pocock's trademark camber, the slight curvature that gave them compression, spring, and liveliness in the water. It was hard to see a clear advantage. It would simply come down to watermanship and guts. When the starter shouted, "Row!" both boats bolted off the line like nervous racehorses held too long in the starting gate. Both crews started off rowing hard and high at 35 or 36. In the Cal boat, the big stroke Gene Birkenkamp, who had mowed Washington down in Poughkeepsie and Long Beach the year before, quickly powered his crew to a short lead. For three-quarters of a mile, the two crews rowed in lockstep, both furiously hacking at the choppy water. In the Washington boat, Dom Hume was matching Birkenkamp's stroke rate, but making no progress in pulling even with him. Then Bobby Mock began to make use of those 3 pounds of brains. He did what was counterintuitive, but smart, what was manifestly hard to do, but he knew was the right thing to do. With his opponent out in front of him, rowing in the mid-30s and maintaining a lead, He told Hume to lower the stroke count. Hume dropped it to 29. Almost immediately, the boys in the Washington boat found their swing. Don Hume set the model, taking huge, smooth, deep pulls. Joe and the rest of the boys fell in behind him. Very slowly, seat by seat, the Husky Clipper began to regain water on the California Clipper. By the one-mile mark, the two boats were even, and Washington was starting to edge out ahead. In the Cal boat, Tommy Maxwell, shocked, glanced over at Washington and immediately called out, "Gimme 10 big ones!" Bobby Mock heard him, glanced back at him, but refused to take the bait. Gene Birkenkamp and the rest of the cowboys leaned into their oars and took the prescribed 10 extra hard pulls. Bobby Mock hunched down in the stern, looked Dan Hume in the eyes, and growled at him to keep it steady at 29. When Cal had finished their big 10, they had not appreciably narrowed Washington's small lead. With the wind in their faces, both crews were fairly flying down the course now, with spray breaking over the bow of their shells as they skipped from wave to wave, the blades of their oars slicing in and out of the chop. Cal had dropped its rate to 32, and then 31 after the big 10, but at 29 the Washington boat continued to inch ahead. Tommy Maxwell called for another big 10. Again Mock held his fire and let the challenge go unanswered, and again Washington held her position, the Husky Clipper's bow perhaps 8 feet ahead of Cal's bow now. In Washington's number 7 seat, a realization flickered through Joe's awareness. The boat was drawing abreast of his father's house on the west side of a lake. He was tempted to sneak a peek over his shoulder to see if he could catch a glimpse of Joyce, but he didn't. He kept his mind in the boat. The observation train was, at that moment, just rumbling behind Harry Rance's house, the smoke from its diesel engines streaming out ahead of it in the brisk wind. Next door, on Fred's dock, Joyce and the kids were on their feet, jumping up and down and waving as they saw the nose of Joe's boat out ahead. Harry stood beside them, his old binoculars locked on the boat, a grin on his weathered face. Coming up on the two-mile buoy, the California shell rolled slightly off keel. A moment later, it happened again. Twice a pair of boys on the starboard side failed to make clean releases from the water, and each time it happened, broke their rhythm and slowed them down. Washington moved out to a three-quarter length lead. Tommy Maxwell, in trouble now, called on his boys to give him more. Birkenkamp took the rate back up to 35, then 36. Bobby Mock continued to ignore him. Finally, with a half mile to go, Mock bellowed at Hume to pick it up. Hume took the crew up to 32, as high as he dared go in the choppy water, and as high as he needed to go. The Husky Clipper surged forward, as George Varnell reported in the Seattle Times the next day, like a thing alive. The boys now had open water between them and the California Clipper, and in the last half mile they accelerated in a way that no shell had ever accelerated on Lake Washington. As they flew down the last few hundred yards, their 8 taut bodies rocked back and forth like pendulums in perfect synchronicity. Their white blades flashed above the water like the wings of seabirds, flying in formation. With every perfectly executed stroke, the expanse between them and the now exhausted cowboys widened. In airplanes circling overhead, press photographers struggled to keep both boats in the frame of a single shot. Hundreds of boat whistles shrieked. The locomotive on the observation train wailed. Students on the Chippewa screamed. And a long, sustained roar went up from the tens of thousands standing along Sheridan Beach as the Husky Clipper crossed the line 3 lengths ahead of the California Clipper. The California crew valiantly rowed on as hard as they could nevertheless. Once again, both boats beat the previous course record. But Washington beat it by a good deal more, coming in at 15 minutes 56.4 seconds, a commanding 37 seconds ahead of the mark. Al Ulbrichtsen sat quietly in the launch at the finish line, listening to the band on the Chippewa play "Bow Down to Washington." Watching his boys paddle over to the Cal boat to collect their jerseys, he had much to take stock of. His varsity had beaten a very good California crew, the defending national champions, and they had done it in difficult circumstances. They had rowed, as he would himself remark to reporters later that afternoon, better than they had ever rowed. It was clear that they were, in fact, something far out of the ordinary. But it was too early to say whether the magic would hold. 2 years running now, his varsity had beaten Ebright's in the Pacific Coast Regatta, only to turn around and lose in Poughkeepsie. Who was to say that this bunch wouldn't do the same? And this year, the Olympic trials loomed just beyond Poughkeepsie, not to mention what lay beyond that. Ulbrichsen remained steadfastly and resolutely doer. The Sunday papers in Seattle the next morning, though, were full of excited talk of Berlin. Many who had watched the events on the lake closely thought they had seen something beyond merely a good crew race. Clarence Dierks, writing for the Seattle Times, mixing his metaphors with abandon, was the first to put his finger on it. It would be useless to try to segregate outstanding members of Washington's varsity shell, just as it would be impossible to try to pick a certain note in a beautifully composed song. All were merged into one smoothly working machine. They were, in fact, a poem of motion, a symphony of swinging blades. Chapter 14. To be of championship caliber, a crew must have total confidence in each other, able to drive with abandon, confident that no man will get the full weight of the pull. The 1936 crew, with Hume at stroke, rode with abandon, beautifully timed. Having complete confidence in one another, they would bound on the stroke with one powerful cut, then ghost forward to the next stroke with the boat running true and hardly a perceptible slowdown. They were a classic example of eight-oared rowing at its very best. George Yeoman Pocock. 2 days later, on April 20th, Adolf Hitler turned 47. In Berlin, thousands of celebrants gathered to watch and to cheer as Hitler reviewed a procession of more than 1,500 tanks, armored vehicles, and artillery pieces rumbling through the city's massive park, the Tiergarten. The crowds along Charlottenburger Chaussee were so thick that people in the back rows had to use rented periscopes to see what was happening up front. Joseph Goebbels' little girls, wearing long white dresses and white headbands, presented Hitler with a bouquet of flowers. The Reich League of German officials gave Hitler a copy of Mein Kampf that had been transcribed by hand onto parchment in a medieval script. With its iron bindings, the tome weighed 75 pounds. But a month earlier, Hitler had already received an even greater gift, and it had been given to him by those who would soon become his mortal foes. On the morning of March 7th, 30,000 German troops had rolled into the demilitarized Rhineland, in open defiance of both the Treaty of Versailles and the Locarno Pact to which Germany was a signatory. It was by far the most brazen thing Hitler had yet attempted, his biggest gamble, and a major step toward the catastrophe that was soon to envelop the world. For the next 2 days, Hitler, Goebbels, and the rest of the Nazi leadership waited anxiously for the world to react. They knew that Germany did not yet have sufficient military strength to survive a war with either France or Britain, let alone the two of them combined. The next 48 hours, Hitler later confessed, were the tensest of his life. He needn't have worried. In England, Foreign Secretary Anthony Eden said he deeply regretted the news, and then set about pressuring the French not to overreact. They didn't. They did nothing at all. A relieved Joseph Goebbels sat down and wrote, "The Führer is immensely happy. England remains passive. France won't act alone. Italy is disappointed, and America is uninterested." Hitler now understood with absolute clarity the feeble resolve of the powers to his west. However, the reoccupation of the Rhineland had not come without some cost. Though there had been no military reaction, there had been a public relations uproar in many foreign capitals. Increasing numbers of people in Europe and the United States were beginning to talk again about Germany, as they had during the First World War, when it had generally been seen as a nation of Huns, of lawless barbarians. Hitler knew it would be much easier for the West to mobilize against a nation of barbarians than a civilized nation. He needed a PR win, not at home, where the reoccupation of the Rhineland had been immensely popular, but in London and Paris and New York. The Nazi leadership was now convinced that the upcoming Olympic Games in August would provide the perfect opportunity for a masquerade. Germany would present herself to the world as an unusually clean, efficient, modern, technologically savvy, cultured, vigorous, reasonable, and hospitable nation. From street sweepers to hoteliers to government clerks, thousands of Germans now went ardently to work to make sure that, come August, the world would see Germany's best face. In the Ministry of Propaganda, Joseph Goebbels set about constructing an alternate reality in the German press, temporarily sanitizing it of anti-Semitic references, spinning out elaborate fictions about Germany's peaceful intentions, promoting Germany in glowing terms as welcoming to all peoples of the world. In plush new offices at the Geyer Printing Labs in southern Berlin, Leni Riefenstahl began putting to work the 2.8 million Reichsmarks the Nazi government had secretly funneled to her through the Ministry of Propaganda for the purpose of producing her film about the upcoming games, Olympia. The secrecy, dating back to the previous October, was designed to conceal from the International Olympic Committee the political and ideological source of the film's funding. Indeed, for the rest of her life, Riefenstahl would continue to insist that the film was merely an artistic sports documentary. But, in fact, from its genesis, Olympia was a political and ideological production. By deliberately conflating wholesome images of grace and beauty and youthful vigor with the iconography and ideology of the Nazis, Riefenstahl would cunningly portray the new German state as something ideal, the perfect end product of a highly refined civilization descended directly from the ancient Greeks. The film would not just reflect, but in many ways define, the still nascent but increasingly twisted Nazi mythos. Following the sweep of California on Lake Washington, Al Ulbrichsen gave the varsity boys 2 weeks off to attend to their coursework and get their personal affairs in order before beginning the final push for Berlin. Once they left for Poughkeepsie, Ulbrichsen reminded them they might not, if all went well, be returning to Seattle until September. There was much to do. When they returned to the Shell House on May 4th, he set them to low-stroke work, still trying to smooth out the last few technical glitches. They rode raggedly for the first few days back on the water, until they found their swing again. But find it they did, and they promptly began to power past the other shells on the lake. But on May 18th, the shadow of academic disaster fell over the crew. Ulbrichsen learned that despite the break, four of his varsity boys still had incompletes and were just days away from being declared ineligible. He was furious. Back in January, he had warned the boys, "We can't tarry with scholastic laggards. Any who fall behind are just out, that's all." Now he dragged Chuck Day, Stubb McMillan, Don Hume, and Shorty Hunt into his office, slammed the door shut, and gave them hell. "You can be the best individual oarsman in the country, but you will be of no service or use to this squad unless you whip up your class efforts. That means study." Ulbrichsen was still fuming as the boys trooped out of the office. Everything was suddenly at risk. The worst of it was that while most of them just had to turn in some overdue work, Don Hume had to flat-out ace a final examination to remain eligible. If there was one boy Ulbrichsen couldn't afford to lose, it was Don Hume. The boys, though, were having the times of their lives. On or off the water, they were almost always together now. They ate together, studied together, and played together. Most of them had joined the varsity boat club and lived in the club's rented house on 17th Avenue, a block north of the campus, though Joe remained in the basement of the YMCA. On weekend evenings, they gathered around the old upright piano in the club's parlor and sang for hours as Don Hume tore through jazz tunes, show tunes, blues, and ragtime. Sometimes Roger Morris pulled out his saxophone and joined in. Sometimes Johnny White got out his violin and played along fiddle style. And almost always, Joe got out his banjo or his guitar and joined in as well. Nobody laughed at him anymore. Nobody dreamed of laughing at him. Don Hume aced his exam. The others finished their incompletes, and by the end of May, the boys were again turning in phenomenal times on the water. On June 6th, Ulbrichsen took the varsity and JV out for one final four-mile trial. He told Bobby Mock to hold the varsity back behind the JV for the first 2 miles. But as they moved down the lake, even rowing at a leisurely 26, the varsity could not manage to stay behind their very good counterparts in the JV boat. They kept edging out in front, simply on the power of their long, slow strokes. When Mock finally turned them loose in the final mile, they exploded into a 7-length lead, and they were still pulling away as they crossed the finish line. That was all Al Ulbrichtsen needed to see. Training was essentially over until they got onto the Hudson. He told the boys to start packing their things and to pack as if they were going to Berlin. That same evening, in Berkeley, Kai Ebright and the California boys climbed aboard an eastbound train heading for Poughkeepsie. Ebright was radiating pessimism. Asked if he had been brushing up on his German, Ebright shot back, "I don't expect to have any knowledge of the language." When he was reminded that he had been just as sour about his prospects before both the 1928 and 1932 Olympics, he replied curtly, "This time it's different." But once again, the doom and gloom was mostly pro forma. Ebright had made some lineup changes since the boys' loss on Lake Washington, and the new outfit had turned in outstanding time trials on the estuary. He knew his loss in the 3-mile race on Lake Washington didn't necessarily tell him anything about the 4-mile race on the Hudson. Not any more than it had last year. At the very least, Ebright must have believed his boys would be in the thick of things in Poughkeepsie. Washington would likely fade at the end, as they had the year before. And even if Washington somehow prevailed, the Olympic trials to follow in Princeton would reset the stage. Washington had yet to show that they could win a 2,000-meter sprint. With any luck, Ebright would be coming home by way of Berlin with both a national title and a third consecutive gold medal. So said the Bay Area press, so said much of the national press, and, one has to believe, so thought Kai Ebright. 4 days later, at 8 o'clock on the evening of June 10th, with red lights flashing and sirens wailing, a police escort led a convoy of cars carrying the Washington crews and coaches down Greek Row, past cheering students, then through downtown Seattle, en route to Union Station. The boys were flying high, and so were the coaches. As instructed, they had prepared for the trip with the assumption that they would not be returning until September. Some of them had even begun to make plans to tour Europe after the Olympics, a heady proposition for boys from Seattle, though none of them was quite sure what he was going to do for money if that happened. Johnny White had a grand total of $14 in his pocket. George Pocock had written to his father, Aaron, saying that he might be stopping by to pay him a visit in London. Bobby Mock had asked his father for the addresses of his relatives in Switzerland and Alsace-Lorraine so he could visit them. His father, Gaston, had hesitated, looking suddenly stricken for reasons Bobby could not fathom, but finally said he would send him the addresses later, if the crew really went to Europe. At the station, as they had in previous years, the marching band played fight songs, cheerleaders danced, the coaches made brief speeches, flashbulbs popped, and newsreel cameras whirred as the boys climbed onto the train. This year the station was packed, not just with students and newsmen, but also with parents, siblings, uncles, aunts, grandparents, cousins, next-door neighbors, and utter strangers. Maybe the city was finally about to be put on the map. If so, everyone wanted to bear witness to the coronation. As Royal Brougham climbed onto the train, he noted that he had never seen a crew leave town with as much cheerful determination and optimism. These lads feel it in their bones. They're practically shaking hands with Hitler right now. But Brougham was worried. He had seen all this before, and he had seen the sad consequences of dashed hopes in Seattle the previous year. He sat down at a typewriter in his coach and pounded out the concluding lines for his morning column. "Don't forget," he warned his readers, "about the haunting specter of that last mile." For now, he left unstated his even deeper concern about the 2,000-meter sprint at the Olympic trials. As the train coughed, lurched, and began to pull away, boys hanging from the windows shouted farewells. "Goodbye, Mom. I'll write from Berlin." Joe hung out a window as well, searching. Then, in a far corner, he found her. Joyce was standing with his father and the kids, jumping up and down, holding high over her head a sign on which she had painted a large, green, four-leaf clover. As the train rolled eastward, the boys kicked back, feeling free and easy. The weather was warm, but not stifling, and they lolled in their berths for as long as they wanted, played blackjack and poker, and revived their old tradition of lobbing water balloons at random cows and sleeping dogs along the way. The first morning out, Al Ulbrichtsen gave them happy news. He announced that he wanted each of them to put on 3 or 4 pounds before they reached Poughkeepsie. The dining car was all theirs, no restrictions. The boys all but stampeded forward. Joe could hardly believe it. He ordered a steak, then another, this time with a side of ice cream. As the boys ate, Al Ulbrichtson, Tom Bowles, and George Pocock convened a strategy session in their coach. They were well aware of what Kai Ebright was thinking, what Royal Brougham was fretting about, and what many in the Eastern press were saying. Washington would